So this is a discussion session on trans-Planckian physics and inflation, or in the CMB. So what I'll do is, as Jim did yesterday, I have about 20 minutes or so of stuff just to sort of set the stage, and hopefully either within that presentation or subsequently we'll have a discussion about some of the finer points. I think the basic idea is something that we're all familiar with in one form or another, but just to lay it out completely, we all know that accessing high-energy physics, short-scale physics, is tough, and that's both good and bad. It's good because, I don't know about you, but I certainly have. I really have tried farming, and I'm not good at it. And if it were the case that we could only do physics by accessing high-energy physics from the get-go, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere, and we all would be farmers. The bad side of it, of course, is we have now theoretical ideas that seem to impinge or to be highly correlated with high energy physics. And if we don't have access to such high energy scales, we're never going to be able to test these ideas. So we've seen over the years that there are many ways you can try to deal with the situation. Sometimes there are indirect signals of high energy physics, for instance, proton decay or the meeting of gauge coupling constants, things which give you clues about what's going on at high energies. And what I'd like to describe in this initiation of the discussion is an attempt to play that, roughly speaking, that same kind of game, but by using the CMB as the tool to try to gain some access to high energy physics. So the idea would be, can string or plane scale physics leave an imprint on the CMB, or turning it around slightly, can observations of the CMB give insider information about string or Planck scale physics? Now, first question is, why might you think that's possible? And the idea is pretty simple. We've seen in many other talks, many of you are far more expert on this than I am, but when one calculates the perturbation spectrum, the power spectrum, that ultimately is translated into CMB temperature fluctuations, when you do those calculations, and I'll review them in more detail in just a moment, where you're taking our small quantum fluctuations, allowing them to be stretched out by inflation, and when they're stretched out, they leave the horizon, freeze out, ultimately they come back in within the horizon, and when they do so, those quantum fluctuations turn into classical perturbations. The classical perturbations are what seed the structure that we see. Now, if you take into account the fact that inflation typically will last at least 60 E foldings, if not a huge amount more, and after inflation ends, the expansion factor is about 10 to the 28 or so, assuming gut scale ending of inflation. So you see that the expansion factor is at least 10 to the 54, if not a whole lot larger than that, which means that the scales that we can see across the sky, which themselves are, say, 10 to the 60, 10 to the 61 Planck lengths, in the beginning, that is, when they were small before they were stretched out, they began sub-Planckian. So the question is, could it be that sub-Planckian physics would actually leave an imprint? Now, you might at first sight think, well, isn't the whole point of inflation to be insensitive to what's happening? Very high energies, very short scales. Doesn't inflation just wash all that stuff away? Well, not completely. I mean, when you think about the fact that the boundary conditions on fluctuating modes influences their dynamics, you can at least imagine that they might leave an imprint. So the only way to know for sure is to do the calculation. You want to calculate the perturbations in the standard way, and then see if Stringer quantum gravity modifications to the standard calculation might survive in an observable way. So that's the whole philosophy behind this particular program. So what I'd like to do in about 15 minutes or so is review things which have already been reviewed, but I'll do it in a particular form that will be relevant for the calculations that we'll be doing. So I'll review the standard calculation. Then we will look at possible modifications, somewhat string and Planck scale motivated, but quite general, in fact, and we'll see whether they can leave an effect on the CMB. And then what I'll do is I'll discuss some of the criticisms and some of the responses to the criticisms so that we can see where this particular program stands. It's kind of, you know, it was almost like a ping pong match for a while. If you actually look at the papers, it was this side, this side, this side. I think it's pretty much settled down at this point. I think pretty much we're all in agreement about the actual state of scientific affairs, and the only disagreement comes in when one asks how reasonable or unreasonable a certain set of assumptions are. So I think we're all pretty much in agreement on what the situation is. Do you guys agree with that? Good, okay. Okay, so standard results. I'll only do the calculation in the simplest of case, which is to consider the tensor modes. If you want to consider the scalar modes, same basic idea, it's just technically more difficult, but as I'm just trying to get out the ideas, let me look at the simplest possible thing. So what do you do? Take the inflationary metric, work in conformal time, look at a small perturbation, the traceless symmetric part of that perturbation gives the two polarizations of gravitational waves, and if you want to figure out the equation of motion that these fellas satisfy, plug it back in, do a change of variables to get rid of the first order friction-like term, and that's the equation of motion that you get. Now, this is a particularly simple equation of motion. We can immediately read off the kind of behavior we expect. When k is large and dominates, we're going to have oscillatory behavior. When k is small relative to the second term, we're going to have a growing and decaying mode, but the relevant one is a growing mode, which you can see just by inspection will grow proportional to the scale factor. So that's the basic classical evolution of these kind of modes, but of course we're really interested in thinking about this quantum mechanically. What do you do there? Well, standard quantization in a curved space-time background looks very much as we are familiar with in the standard Flat-Minkowski quantization. The only difference you really need to bear in mind is that the time dependence of the creation and annihilation operators will be different. It'll be governed by the background evolution of the geometry. A very convenient way of encoding that evolution is to pick some time, call it eta initial, some initial conformal time, set your vacuum condition at that time, if you will, so you know exactly what your AK and your AK daggers do. AK annihilates the vacuum. And then at any subsequent time, we can always express the creation and annihilation operators as some linear combination. The modes don't mix. We got linear evolution here. So we can express them as some linear combination of those creation and annihilation operators at the fiducial time at which we are setting our boundary conditions. And if we plug this fella back in, we can rewrite the fluctuating mode in terms of a field UK. Is there a pointer around? Yeah, can I grab this guy over here? So we can re-express the time evolution of the creation annihilation operators in terms of a field that I'll call UK. And as you can see, everything's linear, so this guy will satisfy the same equations of motion, the classical ones that I wrote down just a moment ago. And then it's a straightforward matter to calculate the power spectrum. It's just the two-point function of the field with conventional normalization. Evaluate this guy at late time, and it's governed by the asymptotic value of that classical mode function whose differential equation I wrote down a moment ago. So it's a very straightforward procedure for picking out this fella here, which then people in this room know much better than I how to turn that into CMB fluctuations, or in this particular case would be polarization since I'm talking about gravitational waves. That's the basic idea. So to summarize, because this is where we will look at modifications, the differential equation for the tensor modes looks like this. Power spectrum amounts to solving this equation at late time, which basically means when a mode exits the horizon, which is this condition over here, the mode will grow like the scale factors. This approaches a constant, and that's the standard form of the power spectrum. Now, of course, to actually turn this into a real quantitative statement, you have to give boundary conditions. You have to give boundary conditions on the differential equation. Typically, what is done is the following. One says, well, let's imagine that we take that initial time, eta I, that initial conformal time, send it to minus infinity. If we send it to minus infinity, the modes are all going to be extraordinarily small at an extremely early time. If they're very small, they shouldn't know about the fact that they're living in some De Sitter space. It should look approximately as if they're in Minkowski space. So impose the standard normalization that we are familiar with from ordinary flat space quantum field theory. If you do that, this is the kind of result that you get. You get the oscillation modes with the growing mode at late times. And in detail, when you use that boundary condition, plug this into the power spectrum and crank away, at least if you do this for the scalar modes, this gives good agreement with observation. Yeah.
Is that early time, they are transplanting, right?
Yes.
That, okay.
That'll be my point in a second.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they're transplanting by many others.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. So it might strike you as a little bit odd to use this kind of reasoning. Now, again, the motivation for this reasoning, you know, isn't ridiculous by any means. People say it's so small, so it should look flat. But why should you assume that flat space quantum field theory works on hyper-transplanking degrees of freedom? You look, yeah.
It's something that's bothering me.
Okay.
About this. I mean, you're assuming flat slicing, right, spatially flat, and this is basically De Sitter space. So this very early conformal time is really just when your flat slices are sort of becoming null.
Yes.
And as they're getting, the distance they're getting short because it's becoming null. But of course, there's nothing singular or anything bizarre about this null surface, which is just the horizon of De Sitter. So, I'm just wondering why this is, you know, such an important. It sounded like when I'm taking global coordinates in De Sitter, you would not have seen this thing shrinking to arbitrarily small sides. You'd get things that would get, you know, big and small and maybe some more.
Aren't we dealing with some more because you don't see there or something like that?
Actually, I didn't quite know what the question was at the end, though.
Well, I guess that was the reason why I wasn't raising my hand. I was just
okay. Sorry.
This is nothing. I mean, the fact that things are getting very short is, in some sense, a coordinate, a gauge artifact. It's the way we're sort of slicing the space-time.
Yeah, but choose your slicing, work in that particular picture, and then the question is this the right boundary condition to use? And all the thing that I can say is what people mumble when they try to motivate this choice.
Modes with wavelengths that is much shorter than the consider length scale.
Or there's another problem. I assume you have really a slow rolling field, then that field, which has already become homogeneous, will set the impulse time slicing. Constant phi was a little
actually.
Then you look at the tensor perturbations on those hypersurfaces.
The momentum is just h. The mode number is h.
One will think that you are not really working in the super space, which you can rotate and
that's well, the physical momentum is K over A. K over A is the physical momentum.
This is how quantization was done. You are working in a computer.
No, it's only H at horizon crossing. We're not at horizon crossing. We're way before horizon crossing. So K over A is much bigger than H.
We are talking, cross-talking.
Yes.
But anyway, I mean, you'd think a conservative point of view might be to say there's a cutoff at the Planck scale.
Yeah,
I won't consider anything below that.
That's where I'm going.
Of course,
save it till I get there because it may be relevant, but if we start to do it now, we're going to get out of water.
Yeah,
K over A, the physical momentum, K over A, is huge.
But one thing, that formula for P to the one half.
Yeah.
You know, at K equals horizon crossing, that is supposed to be the power spectrum after.
Yeah, but if it essentially freezes out, U goes like A, so do it at any time.
If you look at it before.
Good.
Okay? In the early times.
Yes.
That power spectrum diverges quite badly, like K and R. You agree?
Yes, but I'm not sure what relevance that has, since the only thing that I care about in terms of observing it is the late time behavior.
Okay, but what I'm saying is that if you, strictly speaking, apply this formula very early on, to your fluctuation in metric.
Yeah.
You find that the fluctuations are more than 100%.
Yeah, good. But, I mean, the divergence you're referring to, I would also encounter if I was just in Minkowski space as well. I mean, it's just basically the two-point function.
It's related to the fact that you have k over a, and a goes to 0. You see, if you combine your k to the 3/2,
yeah,
the 1 over k, you just get k over a.
Sure.
It's a well-known result that the perturbation goes like the Planck length times omega, times the Crocker frequency. And that problem is blue shift.
Good. Okay. Yeah.
To much, much smaller than 1 over L Planck. So, strictly speaking, perturbation theory is completely wrong.
You hear that? All you guys who do these calculations?
You're saying the power in these fluctuations diverges.
Yeah, yeah. So let's at a very early time, because it diverges like omega times L Planck. And omega is much bigger than 1 over L Planck.
So let's try and make a conservative, you know, what the standards assumption is, which does not, you know, when you do the calculations, you're not assuming that you know what's going on in some plane of space.
That's what I was driving.
Merely
to
say that on, we assume that on short scales, but we implicitly think of scales larger than plane scales.
Yeah.
That's what the,
yeah,
that it will be in the vacuum state.
Yeah.
So you're assuming that you've got something that evolved from where you said the matter could.
Yeah,
and you look at it well, then at larger,
yeah,
scales, but it's
still. But that is a tricky point. It's very difficult,
yeah,
to give boundary conditions at a given time for all scales. And what he says, and I completely sympathize with his point of view, is that you should rather give boundary conditions for each k.
That's what I'm going to do.
K over a becomes
good,
bigger than something. Because otherwise you lose perturbation theory.
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm going. So maybe I'll get there and then we can carry on and see if that helps to deal with it. But that actually is the point. So that's the standard approach. And again, as we've already discussed, the standard approach is basically assuming that standard physics applies on arbitrary short scales. Why would that necessarily be the case? Yeah?
In the discussions I've heard about this, actually that isn't quite the assumption, at least as I understood it. But what was being invoked was always the adiabatic theorem, that when things get,
yep,
to the scales where you can talk about standard physics, that they've been in their ground state, and then they will be in their ground state, and that ground state is now the Minkowski vacuum because of the arguments that you made, but you only make that when the scales are,
yeah,
at a scale where you would believe in quantum field theory.
So
at least that's the way it was always explained to me.
Yeah.
You don't know what,
good,
the theory is before then, but whatever it is, it's adiabatically evolved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because by hypothesis, it has to do with very high frequencies,
yes,
much higher than the rate of change of the scale factor during wind inflation. So the adiabatic theorem should apply.
Yeah, so one of the ways, in fact, that we'll see in a moment to get a different result is to assume that things aren't adiabatic. So, for instance, Brandenburger and company suggest, what if the trans-Planckian physics is such that it modifies dispersion relations in a manner that completely violates adiabatic evolution? And, you know, clearly then, when you do that, you expect to have some effect. Another way of thinking about what I'll describe in a moment, again, is going away from the adiabatic vacuum. So assuming adiabaticity isn't the right idea to use and see what effect that might have.
Are there direct arguments for assuming that adiabatic is wrong?
Are there direct arguments for assuming it's wrong? Beyond saying that we don't know what's going on, no. But that's a pretty strong argument for at least thinking about it. Okay, so what sort of modifications might you think about? Well, you can modify dynamics and you can modify boundary conditions in the way that we have set things up here. And there have been a whole slew of attempts to do either or both of these. So let me just quickly run through to give you a sense of the landscape of work that has already been done, and then I'll focus on one particular way of going about it. So as I mentioned, Brandenburg and Martin modified dispersion relations. They found indeed that the ones which were no longer giving rise to adiabatic evolution in the early moments of these theories would give rise to an effect that you might actually be able to see. Others have looked at the possibility that there might be short-scale non-commutativity in the short-scale geometry, seeing what impact that might have. Another approach, which is part of what I'll be focusing on in a second, along the line of what Gabriella says, to introduce some minimum length, or I guess as David said, and only think about modes that come to life when their wavelength has been sufficiently redshifted, that it's larger than that minimum length, and then think about what boundary conditions to place on those modes and see whether there's some natural way to get some different answer from the standard case. Others have thought about just using effective field theory in the neighborhood of horizon crossing and simply include higher order operators into the dynamics and see what effect that will have. And indeed, you do get an effect. It's typically smaller, at least in the particular approach that these guys took and the approach that these guys took, which I believe these guys agree with. You can get a larger effect by virtue of allowing a certain kind of time dependence into your field modes as well.
So this is in the dynamics of the field, not in Einstein's gravitational theory.
Yes, that's exactly right.
But can you do that with modified theory of gravity?
I mean, you can do basically anything that you want, I presume. These are the most straightforward modifications to calculate. Just keep the framework the same and just modify the... I should say the following. You know, if you're doing the tensor mode calculation and you're modifying the dynamics associated with that, you would turn that back in. That is actually modifying the general relativity equations. If you're doing the scalar modes, then you're just dealing with those fields. Another approach, which we will also make use of in combination with the introduction of a short scale, is to modify the kinds of boundary conditions that you apply at a particular scale. Let me just say what I mean here, because this to me is the best way of going about it. If we all agree that the equations of motion must asymptote to the standard ones on scales larger than the Planck length, that we're pretty clear is going to happen, then of course, you can take a phenomenological approach where you say, I don't know what's happening at really short scales. I do know that asymptotically the equations approach the standard ones, and therefore I can encode my ignorance of the very short scale physics in just the boundary conditions that I place on my modes when they are in a realm that I understand. And that is the approach that we'll actually take. Another more recent type of modification was undertaken by these guys over here, which I might call controlled effective field theories. That is where they imagine you have some high energy physics which does not decouple from the low energy physics by virtue of, say, having high oscillatory behavior in the realm where you'd want to integrate out the mode, and you can't integrate out the mode because it's still going wild. And these guys do it in a controlled way and again find that they can have effect on the perturbation spectrum. Those are the kinds of ideas that have been studied. If I've left any out, my apologies. My apologies to you guys as well. But I think that's more or less the ones that have been studied. Now, I want to focus, just to be concrete.
What's about the papers with Starobinsky?
I'd like to give my apologies to Starobinsky. Definitely there's a lot of... Veneziano as well? No, they're all... I'm just focusing on the ones that are most relevant to the way that I'm describing it here. But yes, there are definitely other papers. By no means an exhaustive list. Just to give you a flavor of the kinds of things that have been studied. Okay, so before focusing on one particular possibility, let me just outline at least the philosophy that I tend to take in these kinds of studies. The real question, I think, is to ask yourself, how far do we need to deviate from conventional physics to yield a potentially observable imprint on the CMB? And after you answer that question, you then say, is the required deviation remotely sensible or is it ridiculous? If it's ridiculous, then you have to ask yourself, do I want to even think about it further? But if it's remotely sensible, then you can take the related approach of saying, well, let the data speak for itself. If it's remotely sensible, why don't we look for it? And if it's not there, that will answer the question for us completely.
What's your answer to this question? You're a person.
It really does depend on the approach that you're taking. I will give one approach now where this, it would be hard for me to actually say that the largest of signals are truly, truly sensible in my gut. But the other way of thinking about it is we really don't know what's going on in the trans-Planckian realm, so maybe our gut has been informed by intuition built up in the wrong regime.
But there is more or less consensus now on the definition of remotely sensible.
Well, I think that's where there will be some deviation of opinion. But there was a time when there was some question on the actual results. And that is no longer the case. I think everybody agrees with the results. The question is, how much do you believe them? Okay, so again, here's the usual case, which I've already reviewed. What is the approach that I'd like to take? Well, maybe I'll draw a picture for this. The idea would be something like this. Imagine, say, that this is our Hubble scale, and say this is time or conformal time. And we know that during inflation, the value of H and H inver stays fixed. Afterwards, starts to grow. And what I'd like to imagine doing is introducing some scale, whatever you want to call it, the string scale, or whatever scale at which you claim that you don't understand physics on shorter scales. And then imagine that modes only come to life. So let's say you have a mode with co-moving wave number k. Imagine these modes only come to life when this thing becomes less than or equal to, say, Ls inverse. So these guys are doing something in here. I don't even know if we can talk about them existing. In fact, that'll be part of the issue with Steve's question. But then they come to life, and then they go through the kind of evolution that we are familiar with. And notice that as you go to higher and higher energy, shorter and shorter wavelengths, the modes will come to life at later and later times, because they have to redshift more and more before this condition is met. So then what we need to do is, to do the calculation, is introduce some boundary conditions on the modes when they come to life. And the freedom we'll have in getting new physics is the freedom we have in choosing those boundary conditions. And then we'll have to take a step back and ask yourself whether interesting boundary conditions are at all sensible in terms of the physics that they might entail. So to make that concrete, the particular boundary condition I will choose is the following. So we imagine, just to refresh your mind on the notation, here are our creation annihilation operators at the initial time. This is what the fellow looks like at some later conformal time. And it seems natural that if eta k is the conformal time at which the mode with mode number k comes to life, have it come to life with a zero particle state. So this fellow over here, being the coefficient of the creation part, beta squared gives us the number of particles in that mode, have it come to life with zero particles. Seems like a reasonable thing to do. Now this is not the same as in the standard case. The standard case would impose this condition at eta k equals minus infinity. So in the infinite conformal past, and then allow the dynamics to evolve. And when it evolves to time eta k, this condition will generally not be satisfied in the standard approach. This is different. The question is, what does this difference lead to? Well, to do the calculation, it's straightforward. What it means is that this mode over here, which in the standard Bunch-Davies case is given by a particular solution whose boundary conditions I wrote down earlier. In fact, I can write down what that mode looks like in the standard case. So this guy looks something like e to the minus I k eta square root of 2k, 1 minus I over eta k. What we want to do now is imagine that we take that conventional solution, introduce some linear combination of it and its complex conjugate to enforce this particular choice of boundary conditions.
Why is it that even though you have professed your ignorance, you can get as much information?
Because he has a specific condition. Beta k zero.
Yeah, I didn't profess total ignorance. Partial ignorance.
Ignorance allows you to make any guess.
That's right. Yeah. So if you like, this is a So my ignorance is I don't know what to do here. So I'm going to make a choice.
But you could just parameterize pressurized.
In fact, that's how we actually did it in the papers. We just wrote down the general result. But let me just be specific here. Because this one intuitively seems like a reasonable choice. Okay, so in detail, what does it mean? Well, I don't know if we can kill the lights, but for each mode, we're going to choose eta k to be the time when the mode is redshifted to a value which is equal to 1 over this cutoff length. That allows us to find explicitly what that conformal time is. That's the expression for it. The condition that we're going to write down, in fact, this condition was initially promoted by Ulf Danielson, the idea of introducing this fundamental, I mean, just historically. So when we first studied this problem, we modified both the dynamics and the boundary conditions, basically because it seemed like a sensible thing to do at the time. What we did was we looked at an effective field theory that would impose this stringing uncertainty relations. Rather than x delta p going like h bar, would have a term proportional to p squared, so that we went to very small lengths, very high energy, the spread in delta x would grow rather than shrink. When we did that, we were forced into choosing modes that only came to life when this kind of condition was met. It was complicated to work out the results because the field theory dynamics were not simple. What Danielson realized was that a lot of the mangling that we had done to the dynamics was unnecessary. Much of the effect was just in the boundary condition. So that is how this particular approach simplifies things. H?
Yes.
H is the Hubble parameter during inflation.
So for this, you assume a constant
H? Yeah, although I will, at the end, write down a result that will be true for power law inflation. So this is absolutely constant H so far. So then, do the calculation, you know everything, calculate the power spectrum, and this is the result that you get. Here's the standard result, and you get a modification that goes like h over m, and it's modulated by this sinusoidal function. That is what you get. Now, the thing to bear in mind here is this would be completely unobservable because this is just an overall normalization. We don't have fixed the normalization. But in response to your suggestion, well, first of all, you do recover the standard result in the limit that a to k goes to minus infinity. But if you're not in de Sitter space and do, for instance, for power law, you'll have effects that are k-dependent that are order h over m because h is changing. So when a mode crosses in to the acceptable realm, you'll have different values of h. So each one will know about a different value of h, and therefore the effect will modulate with wave number. In fact, this is the kind of result that you get. Here's the standard result. Here's the result that you get from the modulations coming from this particular choice of transplanting physics.
Could I advertise my work at this point?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, just because I think it's better.
Good, yeah.
So what we understood is that this boundary condition that Danielson used corresponds to minimizing a certain Hamiltonian at this time. Okay. The problem is that in a time-dependent problem, the Hamiltonian can be chosen in more than one way. It's not conserved, and this is the situation. So what we have shown is that what he minimized is a particular Hamiltonian, which does not really go very fast away to the free Hamiltonian at very, very early time. And if you pick up different Hamiltonians, you minimize different Hamiltonians, you change completely the result. So you go from h over m to h over m square, or even h over m cube effects.
So all this, though, must be reparameterizable in terms of the boundary conditions.
But although it looks
right.
Very natural, what
good.
You say.
Good. So in a moment, I'll say why it's not so natural.
A very, very specific
good.
Choice of an Hamiltonian.
Right.
Now, the evolution is independent of the choice of the Hamiltonian, but the choice of the initial state depends on which Hamiltonian you choose to minimize.
Okay. Yep. So that perhaps is another criticism to put to the list that I'll show in just a moment.
Well, I think I'm doing this. The result.
Yeah, the result is a result.
It can
yeah.
be generalized to power law.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we did complete power law and slow roll cases as well. So that's what you get, and if you then.
Is the effect bigger or smaller for slow roll than for
power law? Really depends on P.
Well, I don't know. You want to answer?
I think it depends on P. I have to check off the top of my head.
Actually, what you find is that the effect depends on h over the cutoff, where h is to be evaluated at the time tk, not at the time of actual exit in the standard way, but the exit from this
from this scale. And so if you have power inflation, H goes down in time. So you'll get, you know, smaller effects for shorter scales, I would say.
That's exactly the right kind of reasoning, but the detail I don't know off the top of my head.
But in any case, the magnitude cannot be large because it's H over M, and H over M is bounded by the overall normalization to be quite small. So you're looking for effects that are much smaller than any other effects of regular...
Unless you, if you are in this crunching universes where H grows in time towards the bounds, and then you get larger and larger effect, but shorter and shorter.
But in a normal situation...
In a normal situation, the effect...
Right. I mean, it's not ridiculous to think that H over M is 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3 if you're really pushing.
So this is looking for effects of 10 to the minus 3 in the cosmic microwave background, which is already itself.
Not impossible. I mean, we were speaking to Dave Spergel and Haronya, and, you know, when I told him it was 10 to the minus 2, he was excited. At 10 to the minus 3, you know, start to run up against cosmic variance. But again, the thing to bear in mind is that these are all calculations so far in the tensor modes. One can assume that the result would be the same in the scalar modes, but the calculation really hasn't been done. So anyway, so if you then assume, as I just mentioned, that it is roughly the same for the scalar modes and just plug in, you find that the CLs will vary by, you know, 0.5% or so, which is not impossible to see. This is, again, assuming that H over M was 10 to the minus 2, which is probably pushing the parameters quite to the edge.
How come this is so much structure? You already folded in a lot of fluid dynamics types.
You know, this is through CMB fast and
whatever
happens in there. Yeah.
Actually, I mean, you seem to be a little over pessimistic in
this good.
Direction, in the sense that why do we believe there's only new physics and the strings?
Sure.
You mean much lower?
It could be most optimistic.
I have a question. So you plotted this in the momentum space, but if you think about it, the power spectrum is basically a Fourier transform in the real space of the correlation function in the real space. So in this case, your modulation is on top of something else. But if you, for simplicity, just consider a flat sim, and you have a modulation, it seems to be the Fourier transform of something. And if you do an inverse Fourier transform, you would expect to get something like a peak at some particular length scale. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Particular position. So it seems to be that you are getting some particular correlation at some particular position.
There is a new length scale, of course, that we introduced, which is governing all of this, which is this cutoff scale. That's the only new length scale that's introduced. I didn't think about what this looks like in position space. But if there is a preferred scale, of course, that's the only one that's in the problem. Okay, so let me now turn to some of the criticisms that we've already, I think, spoken about some of them. But the first one is one which a number of people in this room have worked on. The particular boundary condition that I wrote down, which is the one that Danielson initially wrote down, amounts to choosing a linear combination of the Bunch-Davy modes that we have over here. And that is a kind of vacuum state which has been well known for a long time and goes under the name of alpha vacua, where if you have cosh alpha and sinh alpha as the rotation angles, indeed the rotation is exactly along the lines that I've referred to for a particular value of alpha, which in our case would have sinh alpha on the order H over M. Now, the question is, can you make sense of quantum field theory with in De Sitter space with alpha vacua? So there's been a lot of discussion about whether this...
The boundary condition you were discussing, beta equals zero, is an alpha vacua.
Yes. Although, let me qualify that in half a second. It's an alpha vacua for those modes whose wave numbers are sufficiently small that they'll participate in the generation of CMB fluctuations. For the large ones, who cares? Put them in the standard Bunch-Davies vacuum, and that's why I say it's kind of irrelevant from my point of view. I mean, it's an interesting field theory question. But it's not that relevant to the calculations we're doing here. All the problems associated with alpha vacua happen at the very high modes.
No, I disagree.
You disagree with that, okay.
Yeah. The singularities, the problem with doing perturbation theory in alpha vacua has singularities on the light cone, not just at the tip, but everywhere along. The problem with the I epsilon structure, the singularity structure in these vacua, is not just a short distance problem. I don't mind.
But clearly I can think of this as an excited state around the standard vacuum.
That's a different,
so how can there possibly be a problem?
That's right, but the Feynman rules are different than they are for the alpha vacuum.
Okay, that's fine with me. But I don't consider that a problem.
You're worried with this Hadamard form of the
Fact that you have singularities outside the light cone. You're worried about this.
Singularity. Worried about singularities on the light cone.
On?
I thought on here. But you can calculate. You can treat it as an excited state in the Bunch Davies.
Good.
Factor, if you will.
Yeah, which is a fine way of thinking about it, I think. Good. Okay.
Way to think.
Yeah.
It's different. No particle state.
Good. So this is the way I do want to think about it, and
would it be a different calculation or this one?
It's a different. Well, you have to tell me your Feynman rules. Tell me whether it's the same. Feynman rules that are associated with the alpha vacuum are not the right Feynman rules.
Does alpha vacuum belong to the same Hilbert system?
It can.
Can you hear in regard to that excitation?
I mean, the full alpha vacuum, we do it for every mode? Probably not, but I'm only doing it for a finite number of modes.
In our paper, we looked a little bit at this, about these singularities, and I agree with you. I mean, if we did this, if we applied this precision to all modes, then we'd find problems of singularities. But you say quite clearly that since you do only for up to a certain scale, it's not obvious that you run into that kind of problem.
Right.
It would have been nice to exclude it on the basis of the two-point function doesn't have otherwise singularities on the light cone. As far as I remember, it has singularities outside.
Yeah.
So I just want to make sure I understand this point. I mean, the alpha vacuum were originally defined as being the sitter invariant.
Right.
And you have a vacuum now which sort of has a specific scale on it. You put in this cutoff at the string scale. So I wouldn't expect that to be the sitter invariant.
Right. It's
but
not.
You're saying that they're effectively the same for the
for those modes up to the scale. Yeah, that's correct. Exactly right. Okay, so I think we're pretty much in agreement on that. The next question has to do with large back reaction effects. And this is raised by a couple of people in one particular form, which is, I think, this form here is the one that's easier to deal with. I'll come to the more complicated one in a moment. You have to ask yourself the question, you've rotated away from the Bunch-Davies vacuum. So since you've rotated away from the Bunch-Davies vacuum, you've allowed this guy to evolve, you're going to have particles produced on scale shorter than the horizon. So by the end of inflation, you're going to have within the horizon all sorts of new particles being produced. And you've got to make certain that the energy in those modes is less than the energy and the potential energy that's supposed to have been driving inflation in the first place, or else large back reaction invalidates the whole inflationary picture from the get-go. This one I don't think is a big deal to deal with. If you bear in mind, as we were just describing, that you're not putting any modes whose energy scales larger than the string scale at the end of inflation in the excited state, then the energy density of those modes will go like m to the fourth, and then the number of them just goes as the Bunch-Davies alpha rotation, which, as I said, sinh alpha is order h over m. So the particle number of particles goes like h over m squared, number of particles, energy density in the particles, and you just want this to be less than the energy in the inflaton, which is like m Planck squared h squared. So if the string scale mass scale is less than the Planck scale, there doesn't seem to be much of a problem there. So this was raised, but I don't think it's an issue.
Are you sure you get this square? Yes, you get this square, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because that's beta squared in the notation before, is the number of particles. And
wasn't the correction h over m in beta squared? No?
What was the,
No.
Yeah, so beta squared is the number of particles. That's effectively what beta is. And so I don't think that is an issue. However,
shouldn't you be concerned this with the fluctuations? You're producing particles which have energy densities, and yet you want to sort of have the fluctuations you produce from the quantum. Quantum fluctuations are supposed to be important and significant, and you don't want that modified by other
But I've already calculated I've already calculated the quantum fluctuation, the variation relative to the standard quantum fluctuations, and that was in term of order h over m. Now I'm considering the total energy in the modes less than the horizon. So those are the modes that exit out and come back in. Now I want to consider the modes that are actually in there at the end of inflation and compare to the energy in there with the inflaton.
Actually, it was my impression that what Stravinsky was very strongly related to this last point. And his main point, as far as I understand it, also in his paper with Kachok, that if you take any modification of this adiabatic vacuum, any serious ones that would produce you anything of interest during inflation, then typically the same modification would produce you right now shining sky from high energy cosmic rays produced. So they said something like that.
I mean, if the alpha vacuum persisted until today? But I'm not imagining that happened.
No, you study boundary conditions right now, but at this momenta, close to the stringy momenta, because this momenta right now do exist, and they're still.
But imagining that after inflation, all those modes that you're talking about are in the standard Bunch-Davies vacuum. You can say it's fine-tuning.
Why today the same thing doesn't apply? There are still scales which exit this Planckian.
10 billion years ago, our
you can this you can call this no this can be a criticism of fine tuning, but I can certainly only modify those modes that are precisely relevant for CMB fluctuations. Now we get to the point. Now you get to the point of starting to feel queasy about it all. This is what I was meaning earlier. You have to say, how far do I need to deviate from conventional physics? Then you take a step back and say, do I believe this?
Okay.
So this, you know, I'm not trying to hide anything. It'll be all out here.
But nevertheless, let me repeat his argument. He said.
Sure. I agree with that argument.
I didn't hear what he said.
Okay.
let
him finish.
If the logic behind the study of modification of CMB is correct, then the same logic should apply to the situation right now. Because 10 billion years ago, the universe was 2 times smaller, and the modes which were under this Planckian scale in their wavelengths now become over the Planckian scale or stringy scale, whatever it is, and then these modes will make the whole the same damage as the ones which you study right now, and the damage will be actually quite visible on the sky. And from the condition that it is not visible on the sky in the just like really sky shining, because the Planckian density is moved into larger scale, so you would expect like Planckian density of particles created right away. Okay. So because we do not see it, there should be no effect on CMB. That was his conclusion.
Right. Which, absolutely, if the kinds of changing of the short-scale structure exist even today, then I agree with you completely. So the only
property of the vacuum, so it should exist, of course.
Well, we're in a time-dependent setting, so it's hard to actually know what we mean by the vacuum in a time-dependent setting. So I would say that as that's something, if that is too distasteful for you, that's time for you to exit the trans-Planckian game. You know, at what point you get off the train is up to personal taste.
On the scale of having the cosmological
constant
equal the dark energy today.
I agree with you, but it does.
Because the main argument was that trans-Planckian physics does not depend on the value of H. You see, the Hubble constant was a large area, but it was still much, much smaller than M string. So if you have trans-Planckian energy before, then you have the same problem right away. And if you have the same problem right away, you should see this cosmic rays produced.
Yeah,
if you think of this as some sort of excited state in the early universe on a Bunch-Davies background, then I think you might imagine that at later times, it isn't in that. The states have been changed by the interaction. So it isn't the same. That's why you don't want to think of this as some sort of vacuum state. You want to think of it as some sort of excited state that God created, or maybe Brian.
Certainly, the only way that this can make any sense at all is if today we're in standard vacuum. Whatever words you want to use, if we deviate from that, then there's a significant problem.
Brian, there was a paper on the net by Olson, somebody, 2 days ago, yesterday.
I may have missed it.
So yesterday.
Yes.
Thermalization in the sitter.
Yeah.
Danielson, yeah.
They were claiming that there wasn't such a big problem.
I think that he was saying it is the speed with which you approach the thermal distribution in the sitter space, and he assumed that you must necessarily have some reactions there to achieve thermal distribution.
It's true that if you change the boundary condition, you go to other spaces. If we minimize another Hamiltonian and we get a higher power, then there is no problem. You don't have to be just adiabatic. No, there is an effect, but it's much smaller than there.
Okay.
Maybe
in this connection, I want to.
You don't have
to
go
similar
to
Stravinsky. You don't need inflation to have this Trans-Planckian problem, because suppose that you just look at the Freinon-Robertson-Wolfer expanding universe, right? If you had no inflation, actually, if you go all the way from high scales, the Planck scale is now a millimeter. Okay, go a little down, it would be a tenth of a millimeter. So you have to. There's a problem. This problem exists independent of whether or not you consider inflation.
Is Starobinsky's problem the statement that, I mean, we believe the universe is expanding and some modes are becoming a Planck scale today, mm-hmm. and you're saying just accepting that those modes arise in its vacuum state gives you an enormous energy density because of just the ground state energy? So this is just the cosmological constant problem again?
His attitude was that the problem does not exist, but I mean, he just did believe Planck. But if you make a ridiculous, that's what he said in a private discussion, okay?
Yeah.
Make a ridiculous assumption that leads to Trans-Planckian effects. Sometimes he expressed himself not precisely, and I'm translating. but then, under this condition, the first thing which you should look at is not CMB, but cosmic rays. Because, for example, we have this problem of high-energy cosmic rays. And this high-energy cosmic ray, what is their source? Mm-hmm. Well, that is, if you look at the Trans-Planckian physics, that's the place where to look. The first one.
But there are these very, very high-energy cosmic rays, right?
Yeah, that's what he said.
Can you use it with regard to this observation?
On 10 events, people put the whole new physics
in the
Okay.
Is that true? There's disagreement on... But what about that fly's eye event from... Nothing's confirmed?
So there's a
hybrid.
I see.
So there's a time to
I see. Very good. But the other issue, which we've already sort of spoke about in some form, is the following, which is, if you think about the modes that are required to yield the effect on the CMB, and you just assume that they come to life at this point over here, and you don't think about what's happening down here, just profess complete ignorance, I don't know, maybe you can get by. But then if you say to yourself, what if I actually want to look inside there and see what those modes are doing before they came to life? Well, if you think about it for a second, just energetically, if a mode had mass M string at the time when it was relevant for the CMB, if the CMB was, say, generated through inflation, which had, say, 60, 65 E foldings, then inside the box, so to speak, it had to have a huge energy scale, and it had to be in a state that differed from the Bunch-Davies vacuum early on. Now, this is the argument that Steve and Lenny and Caliper and Klebon and Lawrence were discussing as one of the criticisms of this approach. And again, you know, if you assume that conventional ideas do work, and not even conventional, but, you know, basic ideas of physics still work inside here, then there really is something to reckon with over here. And, of course, there's no answer to it. The only responses that one can think of is we don't know enough about the box to be thinking inside this box, so sort of as we learned yesterday, we should think outside the box. And maybe we should just look for signatures in the CMB. It's not hard to do, and if we see something, I guarantee you, I absolutely guarantee you that if we see a signature, those guys will find a way of making sense of it theoretically. So they will find a way around their own criticism, as will many people in this room. So that basically is as far as this particular approach has gone. As I mentioned, there are a lot of other approaches that people have taken, the McGill group and so forth, but this, I hope, gives you some sense of one particular approach, how the effects it yields and some of the criticisms that it has received. So any further discussion we want to have on this?
I thought one of the arguments was that whatever unconventional thing you do will thermalize back down to the...
Yeah, it's another way of sort of saying the same thing.
That does assume that ordinary thermodynamics
applies
in this.
That's right. Within a few E foldings, any variation from the thermal vacuum will thermalize inside the de Sitter can, and therefore the only way you can get an effect is if just those deviation modes were set up in just the right way that they went through this process and left an imprint. So it's highly fine-tuned is the only way you could possibly get any impact.
Gravity is out of equilibrium, and so is the inflaton. So arguing about whether you can have whether modes have to be in equilibrium misses the point. You really do have things going on which are out of equilibrium even today. So you can't just say, oh, equilibrium. You have to actually look at the physics and see if this is if what you've talked about has to do with the inflaton. There's no reason to think it.
Sure.
Okay, is this argument talking about modes that were inside the de Sitter horizon or outside the de Sitter horizon in scale?
This is talking about those modes that would have had sufficiently small wave numbers that they would have gone through this full evolution, and then tracing them further back into the box.
Okay, and so we're thinking of them at a time when they were smaller than the de
Sitter. Smaller than. That's right, and smaller even than the cutoff, and saying, well, okay, you know, you have to have a huge energy associated with them. In other words, another way of saying it is, you know, there has to be, the language they use, there has to be some kind of pump that keeps populating the modes every time they come to life. Not only do you need a pump, but it has to be a pump that produces the modes in a state that differs from the Bunch-Davies vacuum. We all know that pumps gravitate. Will this physics down here change that kind of reasoning? I don't know, but assume it doesn't. If they gravitate, then there's a huge gravitational back reaction. How are you going to make sense of anything? That's the argument.
We just don't know what's going on there.
Well, you know, that's you can one can hide behind those that set of words, but it should be out in the open as to exactly what it is you're assuming.
Another thing, yeah. At these states, you do have EPR type paradoxes. I mean, whatever went set up correlations outside the horizon that actually can come in and lead to EPR type paradoxes. Now you can't exclude those; these are psychological problems, but they're very seemingly a cause.
Actually, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to, but if it'll take us off course, maybe you can explain it to me more later.
What are
EPR paradoxes?
Well,
the fact is, look,
this is a highly coherent system. And so if you make a measurement on a particle here, you know something about a particle weight that's causally completely unrelated. Okay. But it's not impossible because at some point in history, they were together, or you set it up. But that's the sort of situation that this state brings about. It's very highly correlated systems.
But
you can argue whether that's reasonable, but that's what you're dealing with.
Well, why
is
that
concern?
Hmm?
Yeah. Why should that concern?
Brian, you said that you. I mean, you
I'm
said
saying
this.
You have to decide.
You set this up in general to look at what would happen if you just have arbitrary linear combinations, which gives you a lot of freedom, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So is there some way of parameterizing that phase space and looking?
Looking for signals or?
Signals are.
Yeah, you can pretty much write a general result for what it looks like.
If
And then it's a matter of, you know, doing one of these Fisher matrix type analyses.
You know, if you add these constraints that Andre was talking about, would you, can you then
Well, then you have to say how the state evolves to late time. So there's new physics that comes in. And unless, in other words, unless the alpha for the alpha vacuum is incredibly small today, you run into the problems that Andre was talking about.
I don't think that it is a problem, because when Stravinsky told me that we would have this problem, I told him, you must write about it, because it's not a problem. It's the most interesting thing that comes right now, because you may have, because of this modification of the vacuum at small scale, you may have this cosmic ray production or anything. That's an interesting effect to be studied. So it's not a problem.
But I think there are other bounds, even from terrestrial physics, which show that alpha would have to be so tiny that there'd be no impact on the CMB if it was constant through time. I mean, you can imagine an alpha which changes with time. Does that actually make sense? Some people would say that's a violation of decoupling because you have some microphysical parameter that somehow knows about the curvature scale of the universe. I don't personally believe that argument myself. I think that it is possibly sensible to have alpha being time dependent, but I don't have a good model of it either.
Just to follow up on what Andrei was saying, and again come back to this, the fact that the universe is expanding also after inflation, right? So if you think that, so in that sense, the expansion of the universe after inflation is also a microscope. This is the, right, and it's actually a very powerful one, because if you look like the amount of expansion since 10 to the 13 GeV.
We inflate now.
Yeah.
Just expansion.
I mean,
the scale of the CMB today is Planckian. Yes.
So think about scales that are not quite Planckian, but let's say GATs or 10 to the 10 GeV or so. They are now quite large. And so you might think that if there are changes in microphysics at that scale, you could have some access to them. In fact, that was the way that we used, this is, was the key to the this prediction with the gravity world. So it means that if you have some effects in the early universe, forget now about inflation, let's concentrate on this. After inflation, there is a chance in principle to observe them today because they become quite large.
There would have to be at a pretty big scale, because
for instance, what
you have today, the Planckian scale is good. You're looking at effects on a smooth structure.
The production of the exotic particles you could still think about detecting.
No, but the super cluster scale today.
The Planck spectrum of the CMB. But the BMP is by Planck
evolution.
Because that scale, the 1 degree Kelvin, if you have weakly,
was Planckian, presumably.
Yeah. If you rescale it by 10 to the minus 7.
I guess some organizer should decide which of these two conversations.
Yeah.
I have a question there. Can Denison state be defined in a local Lorentz
which
invariant?
State?
Denison state would be defined in a local Lorentz invariant way, because it makes reference when a specific momentum drops below a cutoff scale. And that's frame dependent. And there is a global frame of the universe, but that's global.
Yeah.
The local measurements aren't sensitive to that frame. So it seems very suspicious.
I mean, one way of,
if you take and average that state over a few scales, that is assigned in there, which averages to zero very quickly. And so it's very sensitive to the fact that it makes reference to this precise,
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, one equivalent way of phrasing the state is just the relationship between the mode and its canonical momentum, which is just, you want it to be the standard one that, you know, pi goes like, you know, square root of k over 2 times u.
There's a phase in there. There's a phase in there because you have these oscillations which start somewhere.
Yeah.
And specifying where that phase is defines.
That's a particular point. I agree.
It's
a very non-local, non-Lorentz invariant thing. And again, you might expect, it really has to be very carefully set up or the phase will average away to zero.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, these calculations are for the CMB, which one imagines doing in the preferred frame, and therefore everything is meant to be with reference to that frame. I don't know beyond that.
in this connection, many of these calculations are done in these modified dispersion relations. Mm-hmm. And the modified dispersion relation will break Lorentz, and the effect is proportional to the breaking.
And the thing that defines the frame is the rolling of the field, which is very slow by any local measurements. You've got to write a really weird Lagrangian.
Or
incorporate
or modify dispersion relation for massless particles, which many of you
do we need a discussion of this?
But it's the
well, the Brandenburger and Martin, when they initiated this discussion, did what people had done with black holes. They looked at various kind of dispersion relations, Corley-Jacobson dispersion relations and so forth, and just figured out whether any of them would yield an imprint. But again, they had to introduce, you know, new parameters into those dispersion relations, which introduced some scale.
The intuition which led us to all saying, yes, it's reasonable to think that moons which, you know, sort of, they don't really, well, we don't know how to make sense of them when they're below the Planck scale, so they become meaningful to think about, at least in this, you know, approximation, when they're at the Planck scale, and it's reasonable to think that they're beginning the ground state. Okay, all those words don't make any reference to inflation. So in reference to this recent discussion, if we believe it, we should believe it, you know, all the time. And modes, whenever they become aboard the Planck scale, should become in their ground state. I see no reason to think that it's true for modes which influence, you know, inflation, but not for modes, you know, say during nucleosynthesis or something, which are becoming aboard the Planck scale.
Yeah, this was Starobinsky.
What's the definition of vacuum state? I mean, well, when you say it comes to life in their vacuum state, what does that really mean in a time-dependent setting?
You're in adiabatic ground state.
Ground state with respect to channel time.
Well, in the time-dependent code, you have this problem of Hamiltonian.
Yeah. Exactly.
Deciding with respect to which other point. But I think there are questions which you can ask.
I mean, there's a certain sense in which people thought of the Bunch-Davies vacuum as the correct ground state. Modes in de Sitter space. So if I made that definition of ground state, keep your words, then we get the Bunch-Davies vacuum, and there'd be no effect.
Yes, exactly right.
So
precisely.
So it's really a question of what you think this boundary condition should be.
Exactly.
Right. In an adiabatically varying situation, the state at any given time is not the vacuum of the Hamiltonian at that time.
That's right.
And that's really the difference between the two.
That's right. Exactly right.
But I think if you phrase it this way, suppose you want to look for how much the cosmic vibrator's vacuum is influenced by the state at the time that these modes were dynamic. Then this, I think you phrase this way, this is essentially what you do. Then you don't have to ask all the other questions. It's just that you don't, because you just ask, you just characterize the state at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look and quantify the effects on the cosmic background. I think it's fair to say that you get small effects.
What do you mean? I think the whole discussion is about small.
Well, I mean, most of the back and forth over the last couple of years was whether the effect was order H over M or H over M squared. And if you do effective field theory, assume the Bunch-Davies vacuum, the effective field theory only has even powers of momentum, so it only has even powers of H over M, so the first non-trivial correction is H over M squared. But that was making an assumption that you were in the Bunch-Davies vacuum, and if you allow first-order corrections to the adiabatic vacuum, which is effectively what this is, you get first order results in the answer. In one sentence, that's what it is.
Maybe it doesn't tell to everyone what is H divided by M, because H divided by M, because of the constraints from gravitational waves, should be approximately 10 to the minus 5 or smaller. So H.
Whoa. What are you choosing for M?
Why?
Why?
No, if you have.
No, string scale could certainly be a couple orders of magnitude bigger than the Planck scale. In fact, in other approaches, it can be much bigger than that.
Yeah, what happens in large dimensions?
Yeah, so Steve and company.
Amazingly large effect, right? The H over M.
Yeah, naively you would think that it. Naively.
No, because, okay, irrespective of the initial
state. And we've answered questions where all
that's. So the two things. One, you know, Steve and company did study some Ojava-Witten type models and where M was larger. And indeed, they did find in certain cases they could get a large effect. I think they even claimed some effects of order one. Now, again, I haven't gone through those calculations in detail.
They were claiming H over M squared. Right?
They were always claiming H over M squared, but yet...
The scale was small.
Right. But if you try to do the most naive thing, just bring M down, you have to be careful too, because then inflation scale comes down and there's compensating effects. So the most naive thing does not give H over M huge, as you might naively expect.
Coming back to this reasonable the word that you were...
Oh, early on, yeah.
So would you consider breaking Lorentz at a very high scale as a reasonable price?
I'm not sure I want to be put in the position of answering. What I'd like to say is, here are the things that you have to do to get an effect, and if you think it's reasonable, think about it further. You know, do I personally? No, not really. No. You know, but I think it's just a first pass. You know, and there may be more reasonable ways that you can get these kind of results.
Like the other things, there's no need necessarily, given ignorance, to restrict yourself to just these free linear combinations. I mean, you have all these models of relations.
Could be nonlinear. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree.
That might give a totally different sense. Why you would assume.
I agree. This is just calculational convenience because you can carry it out. But the way I like to think of it is, if you can find a very good way to, maybe this is what you're actually saying before, if you can find a good way to parameterize all these possibilities with effective degree variables, then you can just study whether there's any effect that you can actually see and use that to constrain those effective parameters.
It doesn't look to me like you have that. Too much freedom. Not a good set of variables.
I would agree with that.
You're gonna have to contain all these constraints.
Right.
Give a good test.
Right.
I mean, a testing
group. Yeah, I think all that this attempts to show is that it's not impossible that hyper short scale physics could leave an imprint that we could see. And now, if one wants to try to make a believable story, you've got to go far beyond anything that's been done.
But would you agree that, I mean, besides the question of initial state, there is this effective theory, which still holds for a little time after the
after. Yeah, yeah.
So, and those effects are presumably there, depend on what higher dimensional operators you get in the theory. So, those will be mixed with other effects due to the initial state. So, the only thing that could possibly survive is this higher order term. The rest is there anyway.
Well, and
it is too small.
And the boundary conditions. And
yeah,
the boundary.
Well, but only if the boundary condition give an H over M, they will stick out.
I agree.
Otherwise, they would be confused with the dynamics.
I agree.
You said higher order term.
Higher order, but higher.
So H over
H over M. So it looks to me that these are the only things you can try to fish out from the initial conditions. And the H over M squared, I think, are typically there. Remember also Steve Schenkel was agreeing to that a few weeks ago. Now the question is whether those are interesting. It seems they are too small because of the bound of H over M, unless M is sufficiently low.
There are two kinds of effects, virtual effects and real particles, both of what are A squared over M, and
yes.
One would be visible today and the other would be much more. So one would suffer from sort of its
H over M or H over M squared?
H over M squared production of real particles would probably still be in conflict with Darwinsky's bound.
I'm not sure. Well,
so
maybe we're talking about the difference H over M squared.
This room, which is what we've been talking
about. I think that would give H over M to the fourth. If you take,
right.
If you take this dimension, you know, this dimension four operators in the effective theory, you get effects which are still under control. I think that's what Darwinsky said. Yes, he parameterizes this. New effect, and I think the only thing you can exclude is this low power of H over M, and not the higher power.
Can you ask
that remember?
The question, is there some in what sense can you convert specification of boundary conditions into modification of the Hamiltonian or introduction of higher order operators?
Yeah,
I guess that's
related to my question. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Is there a precise statement there that is known?
No.
No.
Well, I don't think so.
What do you mean?
No one state.
No.
Well,
no.
Okay, but if you change the state, you can get that by a modification of the time evolution operator typically, and that
yes.
relates to something Tom was saying,
yes.
whatever yesterday.
I agree with
So the question is whether there is a precise map between different boundary conditions in different Hamiltonians.
Well, I think there's not. I think that the use of effective field theory generally assumes an adiabatic condition. We always assume that we can write down a Lagrangian below some scale and start doing physics, but that assumes that there is a coupling of higher scales, and that's essentially an adiabatic condition.
No, but I
think that Burgess and company showed
that's right.
explicitly
they have a good example of that.
The non-adiabatic physics at a scale higher can influence the physics. You can't just get away with doing ordinary effective field theory.
They consider a case where you have very rapidly oscillating.
They have a rapidly oscillating heavy mode.
High energy mode.
Yeah.
That's right. Which, you know, and it hasn't all washed out and settled down. And I think that's the degree of coherence, I think coming back to what Joe said, the degree of coherence of the to get this H over M is just extraordinary. Any new physics that goes on tends to be because things get strongly interacting. Or think, you know, we don't know what's going on, but it moves in the direction of non-coherence. The kind of phase coherence that this H over M effect requires is extraordinary. It's just, I mean, I agree with you that we should see, because it would be a big surprise, but it's nothing we would expect.
Anything else?
So it doesn't look good.
in terms of, shall we tell people like Spergel?
Yeah, I agree.
Look on the sky and tell us this precise information.
Look. So far, there can be no doubt that none of this is high. None of this is believable, and the signals are small. But you know, it's just a first pass.
Go back to another.
Yeah, right.